sex offenders don't get cured, they get caught.
When you find what type of LG they are, it's easier to catch them.
So this was a very brazen offender obviously was not afraid of getting caught.
Oh no.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today, live from Atlanta, is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. It is so great to have Jim here in Atlanta, and we have a very special guest back with us. It's such a nice thing to have our guests in the studio, so to speak, with us, and we have back with us amazing detective, former DeKalb County detective, Atlanta's own, Kevin McNeil.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, Kevin, you are here to talk to us about your worst case.
Yes, sir.
Now, we let everybody that we interviewed determine how they want to pick out the worst case of their career because, well, we all know there are victims involved with every case, and most of these crimes are horrific crimes. And so it's a very difficult thing to pick out a worst case.
Yes, that's true.
So just tell us, what kind of case is it that you're talking about?
It'll be another serial rape case.
A serial rape mm-hmm. case. Yeah, those are very serious cases.
Yeah.
And then tell us what you were doing when you found out about this case.
I was actually working on another case involving a child death. And one of the detectives that was working a rape case, I think, the perpetrator had already attacked two women, had left the unit, and they decided to give me that case and told me to pick up on that case. And because that person had left the unit, I would need to take over that case. So I was actually working on another case when that case came to me.
So it was already labeled as a serial rape case.
It was. It was at least two victims.
Okay. And so what did you do first?
Well, what I did first was told them that I couldn't properly give attention to this case without actually, you know, working a child death case. So I needed the full attention to this case. Initially, they allowed me to do it. And so what I did was I noticed, again, a commonality between the suspect and how he attacked his victims. It was like all victims were cutting through a breezeway or a shortcut. And the woman that were cutting through, they would get attacked by this particular person.
So when you say breezeway, do you mean an apartment complex?
Complex. They were like taking a shortcut from the bus stop to the apartment complex. And so I noticed that those two things was common. So the first thing I did was trying to determine why are we considering this a serial? And does it have the elements that I normally look for? Because I don't look at description, because victims describe things differently, particularly when they're traumatized. I look at those similarities in actions. And so,
right. So what you're talking about is the fact that eyewitness testimony is actually the least reliable type of testimony, especially when the offender is not known to the victim.
Exactly.
And so those are the situations. So you don't put, what you're saying is you don't put a lot of weight on the physical description of the offender because the victims are going through trauma.
Yeah, and they will give different descriptions, and sometimes detectives rely too much on physical descriptions, and when one physical description is thrown off, they automatically say it's a different perpetrator.
So you're doing your job. You're going back, and even though it wasn't your case to begin with, you want to verify all of the details.
Definitely.
And go back and sort of behind the work of the other detective and just make sure that you are dealing with the kind of case that you've been told you're dealing with.
Yes, definitely. I want to make sure that if I'm going to have the case, that I'm putting together my investigation and not relying on someone else's investigation. That way, when I get to court or trial, I'm able to explain my work and why I chose to do it the way I did it.
So you were working in DeKalb County as a detective, special victim detective, right?
Yes.
at the time. So obviously these assaults took place in DeKalb County. What part, for those of, we do have a lot of listeners in Atlanta, okay. my hometown.
I got you.
What part of DeKalb County were you operating in for these cases?
See, that was so difficult about them. These persons was like, they would do like the Stone Mountain area, and then they would move to the Lithonia area. And then they will move to like the Shamley area.
So well, how DeKalb far apart are those? DeKalb is a big county.
Yeah, that's
so
pretty
that's,
big.
That's far. Yeah. That's a 30-minute drive.
Mm-hmm. So now you can see why the supervisors and people in the unit thought that there was no way possible this was the same person. Because they were dependent on locale. Like, as if suspects don't have vehicles.
Yeah, that's never happened before. Yeah, that somebody moved from one location to another to commit crimes. Never heard of that.
To me, it's sort of shocking. The person didn't cross county lines.
Yeah. So that's what really... kind of, I think what made them determine it was a serial, because two of them happened, the first two happened in that particular area, and like right down the street from each other. So they focused entirely on that area. So what happened was, when I got the case, it went cold.
But let me ask you something. Mm-hmm. After those first two cases in that one area,
mm-hmm.
did that prior detective concentrate his investigative attempts in that area?
Yes.
So wouldn't that maybe be the reason why this offender moved to another location and another location?
Because not only did we concentrate in that area, we did like the whole foot patrol with the officers there stopping and knocking and talking, you know, old-fashioned district detective work. And so, of course, people weren't talking. No one knew the guy. We was going showing sketches of people we had. Of course, no one said they knew the guy. And so, of course, everything went cold. You know, I was left with no trail after that.
I think that's probably the hard, to me, it's one of the hardest things mm-hmm. about being an investigator is you've got a case, you've got a criminal. This is a serious, dangerous offender who's, you think at least, has offended more than once. There's no reason to think he's going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you, not only do you not know who he is, but you're stuck not knowing how next you can proceed.
Yeah, because that bothered me, because one thing I knew about having worked so many cases, you know, sex offenders don't get cured, they get caught, right? They don't stop. They don't stop because they had an enlightenment or epiphany that they did something wrong.
Jim, that's my new computer wallpaper. Offenders don't
get cured.
Sex offenders don't get cured, they get caught.
Yeah. So, you know, I knew
unfortunately,
that.
Very few of them get reported.
Yeah.
Fewer of them get caught, and fewer of them get convicted.
That's true.
So there's a lot out there that continue to offend over and over and over again over the course of their career.
That is definitely true, yes.
So, Kevin, it was cold. Your trail was cold.
Yeah, it was
but
cold.
But that's not going to stop Detective Kevin McNeil.
Not Kevin McNeil that I know.
No. And so it was actually frustrating because, you know, the powers that be said, hey, it's gone cold. We need you to continue working on your other cases. And so the case file sat on my desk, and I was going, I need to work this case because this guy's not going to stop. Well, he has stopped. We can't let you continue to take your manpower, your expertise, and work on this one case when we got other cases pending. And that was very, very frustrating.
And that's a lot of pressure, right? And same thing that prosecutors and agents experience is mm-hmm. if there is any kind of hesitation,
mm-hmm.
the instinct of everybody above you is to say, move on to the next thing. And, of course, for you, too, there's a lot of pressure to move on to the next thing because, unfortunately, there's a lot of next things happening.
Yeah, that's true. But you can take it kind of personal, particularly when you sit down with victims personally and you hear the pain coming from them. You kind of take it personal as a responsibility.
That's what motivates you, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I get my passion from. You know, you take it personal. Like, I don't see this as a case file. These are people, right, that I know I got to bring closure to. And so that was the most frustrating part, that I wasn't given the time and the opportunity to work that case like I wanted to.
Okay.
So, so what happened next? I mean, what picked it back
tells
up?
Tells me you mm-hmm. did manage to do
I
that.
Did, because I was doing a little bit of stuff. Like, I was finding out there was a store there. So I wanted to show the clerks on each shift, like, do you know this guy? And, you know, you would get clerks that where people load in front of the store all the time. And so nobody had anything that they can come up with. So I just started going to apartment complexes, like sitting. Like, I would just sit. No one knew where I was, and I would just sit and watch. And just watch and see if I saw anybody that possibly looked like them. And then I went to the trails that the person went through to make the assaults and got nothing. And I was like, okay, this is upsetting. And then I said, okay, you might want to take your search elsewhere because this stopped. Maybe this person moved. So I go to the leasing office to see if there was any recent move-outs, right? Mm-hmm. So to see if this person stayed in this apartment complex that was near both of these trails. could I get all the persons who have moved?
So you're doing a bit of geographic profiling here in order to try to figure out whether the offender was someone actually local to the
area. And then the one victim was coming from that store, so possibly this person was watching them. And so I'm thinking, okay, this person had to be around this store watching them go through this cut because it's very dark. You know, it's very dark. You have to see a person actually going in time your assault as they're going through the cut.
So we didn't actually ask you, and I should go back. One of the things our listeners online always ask us, because Jim and I get so into your story that we forget, is people say, let's a little more detail about the actual case and crime itself. So you had information from these two women, or at least one of them, who had left a store and were walking home toward their apartment, right?
Yes, exactly.
And so could you tell us a little bit about what they described happening to them?
They said they got into the cut and they felt...
So you keep saying that. They got into the cut.
Yeah.
You know what that means.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, that's like a shortcut people use. Instead of going all around the corner and go to the front of the apartment complex or front of the street, they just use a cut through some woods, very dark areas to cut off some time from that
very
walk.
Unsafe for convenience.
Yeah, right? And so, yeah, so...
So she was walking through this shortcut, and what happened to her?
So she hears some footsteps, which was not uncommon because everybody takes that cut through. But the footsteps kept getting quicker and quicker. And so when she stopped, she felt a hand over her mouth, guy pulls her into the woods, and then puts a gun to her head and tells her, you know, you're going to suck it or you're going to die. And so she says,
what a horrendous experience.
Yeah. And so she does it, and he goes to try to penetrate her. And she tries to fight, and that's another thing that he did. He beat her. He's physical assaulted her. Yeah. And so then he told her, you know, lay down, don't look at me, and don't get up immediately. You know, so that's another thing I'm listening for, the wording that the person is using.
That's really good. And again, all that kind of stuff goes into VICAP.
Yeah.
And, and the specific language that's used can actually tell you what type of rapist that person is.
Yes.
In other words, there are multiple different typologies of rapists, and there's power reassurance, power assertive, anger retaliatory, and then the sexual sadist. And each one will use different kinds of language and different kinds of behavior. And what's great about that is when you find what typology they are, it's easier to catch them because you can then predict their behavior based on who they are and what they're doing. And also, when you do catch them, you can build a better strategy to interrogate them based on their personality.
Definitely.
So what does this sound like to you, Jim? What type of rapist does this sound like?
Either power assertive because he is physically violent with them, or anger retaliatory. I don't know how it would go to the actual specific language and the degree to which he beat them.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, because it actually was the anger and retaliatory.
Really?
When I discovered it. Yeah. When I finally got to interview him, we finally got to interview him, we found out what was his motivation.
So going back to the assaults themselves, these women had to endure. Did both of them come forward relatively quickly, and so were there the usual evidence-gathering techniques, photographs of any injuries and you know, a rape kit or DNA taken?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Both of them came forward, and when they came forward to me, one of the things I wanted to put it into the database, because we had male DNA come back, but of course, when it didn't come back matching anything, then I had to develop a theory. Either this person is extremely young, or this person hasn't been in any trouble, incarcerated for any felony crime.
So that brings up a great point to our listeners. We have very sophisticated listeners, so they probably all know that. But one of the things you can do to try to identify an unidentified offender when you do have male DNA, which it sounds like you did in this case, is run it against the FBI's DNA database. And most felons in this country now, in every state, and certainly federally, their DNA is taken when they're arrested or when they're convicted, depends on the state. But so you ran his DNA against that database, and you
nothing
came up empty.
Yeah, nothing.
But another thing that you can do these days is actually do a composite, a DNA composite. In other words, there are companies out there that can actually put together a composite based on the genealogical data that's contained in DNA. And they can say what race this person is or what mixture of race this person is. They can say how old generally or how we would look at this particular age.
Oh, wow.
And they can literally put together hair color, eye color, everything to tell you what this person would look like.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing.
It is amazing,
but I
should... Costs money.
I was just going to say. But most police departments, I guarantee you, DeKalb is one. just are never going to have the amount of money necessary to get those kind of profiles, which would have helped you. But you are Kevin McNeil, and you didn't need any fancy tests because you did old-fashioned detective work. So tell us what happened next.
What happened next was I put those things together, and like I said, the trail went cold. And the case, I was sitting on my desk, and I wasn't allowed the opportunity to really work the case. So I started working other cases. And I think a couple months later, a call came in, and I was listening to the call, and said that a young lady was walking through a cut, right, in a car, and she was assaulted.
Oh,
and
no.
The person who assaulted her actually attempted a sexual assault, and she fell back, and he pulled a gun out, put it to her head, and killed her.
Kevin.
Yeah.
God. So the trail goes cold, and he killed someone.
Yeah, he killed someone. And we were able to get video surveillance from that. It was broad daylight. We were able to get video surveillance, and because we got video surveillance, that's how we identified who it was.
So it was broad daylight he assaulted and killed this woman.
Daylight.
Were the other attacks in the daylight?
One was, and another one was at night.
So this was a very brazen offender obviously was not afraid of getting caught.
Oh, no. He wasn't at all. He wasn't at all. So that really bothered me.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
That's one of the things we talk about on this podcast is why we tell people we're taking them behind police lines, because we do want to know how this kind of case impacts you. When you got that call, tell us what you thought.
Well, first, I didn't want to believe it was my guy. I just was hoping and believing that wasn't my guy. But when they said she was coming through a cut through near an apartment complex, you know, my instinct says, you know, and it was in a different area. And so I was just hoping that this wasn't the guy, you know, that possibly this was a different person.
Because even though you certainly weren't responsible, you must have felt guilt about
it. Oh, yeah. And I felt responsible. I felt like, could I have done more? Could I have, you know, did more? But that was no way of me knowing, you know. Because the trail went cold for so long, and it was a totally different area, and I just felt bad about it. Just felt real horrible.
Well, of course you did. So now you've got the call, you've got surveillance. What happens?
Well, what happens after that? We identify who the person is. We're able to identify who he is, and then we send out search warrants. We actually capture him, and when we catch him, actually they captured him, and I was not at work, and I think I was either out of town or going out of town, and they said we think we got your guy, and so. They wanted me to come in for an interview, and I wasn't able to, but I knew two good detectives in the office that I can probably have conduct the interview. And so I told them the things I wanted to ask, some particulars that I needed to know to make sure that this is the guy that I was looking for. And they interviewed him, and, you know, ironically, the female detective was the one who was able to get to him. He had an issue with the male detective.
Really?
Yeah. So him and the male detective, you know, they got into it a couple of times. But when the male detective left, female kind of played the, you know, like I always tell special victim detective, if there's a victim in your suspect, find the victim first and interview the victim. So that's what she did. Mm. She played, allowed to see if he was a victim. And that's why I say he was angry, retaliatory, because come to find out, he said that one day he was walking through a cut through an apartment complex, and the guy asked him if he wanted to buy some weed, and he said yes, and the guy pulled a gun on him and sexually molested him. Mm. So he said that's why he did what he did. He was angry. And so that's why he was hanging through the cut-throughs. And so it's almost like he was retaliating.
Well, also, he's trying to gain back his masculinity somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, obviously that's a twisted, ridiculous,
yeah.
and criminal way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's how people rationalize. Some people rationalize their behavior.
Yeah.
My feeling is... Mm-hmm. My professional opinion is that he had the propensity already to do that.
Oh, definitely.
He had the desire and maybe built up from... How old was he when you got him?
He was, I want to say 17 or 18. He was very young.
Okay. When you got him?
Yeah, 17 or 18.
17 or 18, and he already committed at least 2 rapes and murdered a woman.
Yep.
Wow.
Jim, wow.
Yeah.
Well, I would be very, very surprised if he hadn't had... rape fantasies before that.
Oh, yeah.
That he actually acted it out. It gave him permission. Being victimized gave him permission to act out these fantasies that he had already.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah, and actually, it was interesting. He had a very bad relationship with his mom.
Oh,
yeah.
Now we're getting very into some profiling details, Jim.
Yeah. His mom didn't think he was good enough. Thought he was, used to call him names and embarrass him. And
what kind of names?
She would say that he has a demon in him. He's evil. Things like that.
Well, sadly, evil does describe him.
Yeah.
Well.
Based on his behavior.
Yeah, but Francie, I always say that if you call an offender evil, you're basically elevating them to a plane higher than normal humans. He's a criminal. He's a bad person. He's doing horrific things that he's deciding to do. Mm-hmm. If you call him evil, it's almost like he has no choice or that he can't be stopped because he's so powerful. So that's why I avoid saying that.
I don't know. I've done a lot of closing arguments where I called offenders evil. Maybe it's my Southern upbringing. Good and evil is really important and emphasized here. But I totally hear what you're saying, Jim, about it's, you know, it's criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I believe that it's criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. So let's get into the sort of nuts and bolts of what happens next. You have your offender. He clearly confessed. Did he confess to actually killing the woman?
Yes.
Or just the rapes?
He confessed to everything. He confessed to killing the woman. Said he was angry, you know, because he tried to rob and she fought back. And there was one other victim that fought back. And that victim, we found she was on the side of the road, kind of beat really, really badly. The second victim in the club that he pulled a gun on came up behind. She cooperated with him. And that's the only reason he didn't assault her physically.
You know, Jim, that brings up a great point. I think it's a great question that I'd like you to sort of address for our female listeners. Because I've definitely been given conflicting advice. Men, women, you know, experts in the military and police about what to do in a situation like that. And I think that brings up just a great point you could help our listeners with potentially. As a woman, what do we do? You know, do we cooperate? Do we fight? You're taught very conflicting things.
Mm-hmm.
Fight them, scream, yell, struggle. And if you don't, you're later perceived, maybe you aren't actually a victim, right?
Yeah.
So you're thinking that in your head. You get that from TV and then the movies. But as happened here, sometimes if you do that, you may die.
Yeah. Okay, so it really depends on the typology of the rapist. And so, of course... women and men who are potential victims of rape have to know the typology before they decide how they behave. Because, for example, anger excitation or sexual sadist rapists, they actually get off on causing and witnessing the pain and suffering of others. If you don't react, if you're not afraid of them, if you're not scared and in pain because of their activity, they're not turned on. It can turn them off. But the problem is with those people, they're very violent, they're very dangerous, and they might kill you either way. But with somebody who is a power reassurance rapist, they literally in their minds are justifying it by saying it's a date. And they'll use a weapon only to control a victim. They will rarely ever use it against the victim. They won't be that violent. They won't do the kinds of things that you describe in this case. Typically, those are the offenders that, if you try to humanize yourself to them, in other words, talk to them, tell them your name, tell them, you know, you have a daughter, tell them, you know, you have dreams and hopes and desires, and if he just comes back another time, they could actually date. And some of these offenders have actually given their phone numbers to victims who have talked them out of this. Or even after they've been raped, they've said, they played it as if, okay, I'm not going to say anything, you know, we'll just consider this a date. And the way you know if somebody's a power reassurance rapist is typically they will say things like you might hear in a date. Is this good for you? Am I better than your boyfriend? You should take care of yourselves. You should be careful not to leave the windows open or the doors open or walk here at night. That's the kind of thing a power reassurance rapist would say. Power assertive rapist would be the kind of person who would say, I'm strong and I'm going to prove it to you, basically. And so their statements would be more sort of like proving their masculinity and so forth. And they might use more force than, they would certainly use more force than a power reassurance. But anger retaliatory will usually start with force. Their goal is to punish the victim. They're not there to prove themselves. They're there to punish women basically for being, you know, women. And that's an overarching point to all, or theme of all of what they say and do. So in that case, what you want to do is differentiate yourself from the women that have hurt them. You know, I would never hurt you. I'm not that kind of person. You know, obviously you've been hurt or you wouldn't be doing this. You know, play into that part of it just like the detective did. And that should calm them down and separate you from the ones they hate. So that's for anger retaliatory. The power assertive, to calm them down, would be to basically say, you're the man. You're the man, I understand, and all that, and give them their props. I mean, it's a horrible thing to have to do, but that should calm that person down, and it shouldn't escalate because of that. It's just a very, very difficult situation. It's a horrible situation for anybody to be in. So the best thing to do is to be aware of your circumstances at all times. Situational awareness is one of the first steps in protecting any person, male or female, from victimization. So, Kevin, tell us a little bit more about the resolution of this case.
The resolution, once he confessed, we were able to get him to confess. First of all, we started with the shooting, the one we knew that we can put him with.
Because he's on video.
He's on video. And so we started with that one, and then we actually told him that we had other victims that we know about that he committed crimes against. And at first, you know, the typical suspect starts playing games like he don't know what he's talking about. Mm. But of course, he slowly, once that detective began listening to him, and he slowly began to confess to the other crimes as well and walk them through what happened as a result of that. And so, and I think DNA came back also, kind of solidified the case. And as a result of that, he went to trial. Well, he didn't go to trial. He didn't want to go to trial because I think that was they were considering offering death. And I think he pled to a life sentence.
Well, because in Georgia, we're a death-eligible state, death penalty state, and with the commission of the murder within the commission of another crime, mm-hmm. the rape, that would be called felony murder and makes him eligible for the death penalty.
Yes.
Even at 17, mm-hmm. In Georgia, is considered an adult. And it's obviously difficult, and an issue Jim and I have debated with respect to the death penalty. This guy is clearly a true serial predator and a danger to women, I think, for the rest of his life. But he decided that he didn't want to take that chance. And one of the things that prosecutors have to weigh in a case like this is safety of the community. Does the community want the death penalty? What are the people saying? What's best for justice? what kind of sentence is best for justice? Do we put the victims who are surviving through a trial, all of that? And so in this case, what you're saying is he didn't want to risk the death penalty, so he probably agreed then he would plead guilty to all those crimes.
Yes, he would plead guilty to life. He didn't want to take the chance of going to trial and them coming back with a death penalty. So, and that's what he decided to do. But a detective, you know, like I think if it wasn't for the female detective and the method that she used, because the male detective was kind of used their male bravado, trying to tough it out of them, and that wasn't happening. And
right.
It was probably good I wasn't there, because I probably tried to do the same thing. So, hey.
Well, it just shows, though, so with the critical importance of things like investigative skill, I mean, interrogation skills, and Jim, that's something you train police and agents about.
Yeah, and I think what was amazing in this case, a case where this guy was definitely an anger retaliatory rapist, for a female detective to have built rapport with him and got him to talk, I mean, her skill level must be incredibly high.
Yeah.
And so she's a co-hero, or a shiro in this case, with you for having done what she did, because obviously having him confess and having him plead guilty to this crime made it 100% certain that he would get justice meted out to him.
Can we call her out? Can we give her props that she deserves by name?
Well, we can.
Do you have trouble with that? Or is that okay?
Detective Evans. Her name is Detective Evans. She's awesome detective. You called it. She's an awesome detective.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, you know, behavior speaks for itself, as I would say.
That's true.
And so that's an awesome thing. And so tell us, we know this is a difficult case, but tell us why this case sticks with you as a worst case for your career.
Because I run through the, if I could have done this, could I have prevented that? Like, if I had the time, should I have done more? Should I have actually, you know, said, you know, and gone to someone else and said, listen, I need to work this case. And who knows, I may have not could have prevented it, but that's still something as an investigator, somebody who cares about their work, you kind of figure, you know, I wonder could that have been prevented if I had done more than I could have done. And so that's why it bothers me. Like, I stick, like, could I have saved the life by getting this guy off the street earlier, by really pushing the issue, by having the other case, or the one case where he beat the female really badly, like, that was enough for me to say, hey, we need to do more. This guy's going to get worse. And, you know, my fear was proven. And so I just think the reason it's the worst case for me, I don't think as an investigator I tried hard enough to really make a point that, hey, we need to get this guy off the street as soon as possible.
It's a terrible struggle that good cops have all over this country, and that is they never have enough resources. We're always stretched too thin. I know when I was a young prosecutor, I had 200 cases in my caseload. And you just can't really address them properly. And I'm sure when you're in a situation where you have multiple cases that all need your attention, I mean, I'm sure you didn't go off this case to do nothing. You were doing another case that also had victims and required your full attention. Mm-hmm. It's just unfortunate that you don't pay cops enough, you don't have enough cops, and you put them in a situation where they have to choose between, you know, one case and another case, and it's unfortunate, but certainly it's not your fault. And I'm sorry that you feel that way, that it still haunts you, but it's a testament to your humanity. And I think it's a great lesson for people out there who are listening, that police officers of whatever variety, they are dedicated, the vast majority of them, to doing this to help people, not to hurt people. These officers don't want to use their guns against people. They want to use their brains and their investigative knowledge to stop offenders from victimizing other people. And that's their goal in life. Is that how you see it?
I definitely see it that way. That is, I couldn't have put it any better myself. That's what we get up every morning to do. And we go out of here and we really care, because these investigations are a part of who we are. We just can't, I mean, you can't go to bed at night and forget what you saw. You can't unsee what you saw. And then we sitting down with victims who are telling their stories, and that, you know, being a part of humanity, it affects you, because you know that unless you really put forth an effort and care about what you do, you're really not going to have a good impact on these people. And you're going to have an impact one way or the other. Right. So yeah, that's definitely how I see it. And there are men and women in uniform who do this job, who get up every morning, you know, hoping that they can do a better job, hoping that they have the resources, hoping that they have the backing of the department, of the community that can help them. So yes.
Well, and Kevin, thank you for all that you've done for the county of DeKalb, for the city, for the state of Georgia, and for the country. With all of your hard work and dedication, I think it's clear to all of our listeners that your career can be labeled super detective, because you cared, but you were smart and dogged, and I just admire that so much, and just want to say thank you for all you did, and thank you for coming in and telling us your story.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin McNeil. Super detective.
Yes.
And now we're signing off on this edition of Best Case, Worst Case.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba. And hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Knowledge is power, and when we know the facts about sexual abuse, we can better protect kids. Darkness to Light has already trained more than 1.4 million adults to keep children safe from sexual abuse.
I'm one of those 1.4 million, Jim. Using their Stewards of Children Prevention training, they give you and gave me the facts, tools, and tips I needed to help keep the kids I love safe, and you can do the same with their Stewards of Children Prevention training. Get trained today to prevent, recognize, and react responsibly to child abuse in your community.
Learn more about Darkness to Light and child sexual abuse prevention at www.d2l.org. That's D, the numeral 2, L.org.